Chapter 1, Year 776 of the Great Barrier. Like a chick in its egg, Jenna lay curled within a bubble of ice, half buried in muck at the bottom of Palace Lake. In her gloved left hand she clutched the frost-covered spellstone that kept the walls of her shelter frozen, teased air from the blue-green water, and slowed time. After a day and a night she should have been so cramped from immobility she would not be able to move when the time came, but to her it had not been a day and a night. To her, it seemed only a few minutes had passed since she had waded into the lake in the early morning darkness. Her thoughts, though flowing normally to her, in fact moved with all the sluggishness of treacle in midwinter. She had left that cold the day before, passing through the single gate in the lesser barrier into the palace grounds with a dozen other young women, newly hired to serve as maidservants. And what happened to those we replaced, she thought bitterly as she waded in her bubble of ice. Some have grown too old, some have grown too ugly. And some have simply vanished, used, abused, discarded, no questions asked, no investigations launched, no retribution, no recompense, because those doing the using and abusing and discarding were mage lords. The spellstone filled her left hand, but her right held something else. A tiny crossbow, cocked and loaded, the quarrel white with frost, steaming with cold. Around her neck she wore a third item of magic, a simple silver circlet, broken in one place, hanging on a cord of leather. In her time-slowed memory, it had been only a short while since Venther had hung that amulet around her neck. "This is the power source," he had said. "Keep it hidden." She had nodded and pushed it down inside her blouse so that it lay, cold at first but warming quickly, between her breasts, glad that at least it did not glitter with frost like the spellstone in quarrel. "The spellstone knows what to do," Venther told her. "The moment you are completely submerged, it will form your..." He hesitated, searching for the word. "Blind?" Jenna suggested. "I am going hunting, after all." Venthor smiled at that, but it was a smile tinged with sadness. "I wish someone else could do this," he said softly. But only a young woman hired to be a maid can get inside the lesser barrier," Jenna said. "I volunteered, remember, Venthor, when you told us what the patron needed?" She remembered the pride she had felt, the excitement that at last she could strike a blow for the commons, for her mother's sister, the aunt she had adored as a small child until suddenly she wasn't there anymore, vanished like so many others in the service of the mage lords. That memory brought a fresh surge of hatred to her breast. "I want this, Venthor," she said. "It's the greatest honor I can imagine." Venthor nodded, lips pressed tightly together. "Of course. And I have every confidence in you, as does the patron." He put a hand on her shoulder. "I will be watching," he said, "from outside the barrier. When you strike your blow, I will bear witness to the patron that you did your part and did it well." That had been their farewell. There was nothing else to be said, because they both knew that, whether the attack succeeded or failed, Jenna would almost certainly not survive. It was one thing to get inside the lesser barrier, another entirely to get out of it with the royal guard in full cry. And that was why Jenna carried one other small object, not magical at all, a simple glass vial filled with a fast-acting and fatal poison. Whatever happened, she must not be taken and questioned by Lord Falk, the Minister of Public Safety, and so, whatever happened, she would not be. She took another long, slow breath. Subjectively, her wait had not yet been long, but it didn't matter. Long or short, it would end eventually. Eventually, the prince would come. And then the prince would die. Not 10 strides from where Prince Karl and his bodyguard Taran sat in magical sunlight on soft green grass, a snowstorm raged. Warm enough with only a wrap around his waist, Karl watched snow slithering across drifts that ended abruptly, flat as knife-sliced slabs of cheese, against the lesser barrier, visible only as a slight shimmer in the air like heat waves rising from a fire. Then his eyes narrowed. Something was moving out there. "Taran, look!" He pointed toward the barrier. Taran, who had been gazing across the lake at the palace, twisted his head around to look as a shadow took shape, materializing into a commoner who was struggling through the snow-choked park on the other side of the barrier. Swathed in a knee-length coat of black fur, with throat, mouth, and chin wrapped in a dark green scarf beneath a huge fur hat, the man raised his head as the light of the mage sun fell on his face. His eyes met Karl's. For a long moment, a few seconds longer than strictly proper, Karl thought, he stared at the prince. Then he lowered his head and plowed on. Within seconds, he had faded back into the swirling gloom. "He didn't look too happy with you, Your Highness," Taran said idly. Being technically on duty, he wore his guard uniform of blue tunic and trousers, silver breastplate, and high black boots, but he had set his helmet aside on the grass and his sword next to it. His right hand held a dew-covered bottle of old Evrenfels amber. Drinking on duty was definitely against regulations, but the only one who could report him was Carl, and Carl had given him the bottle in the first place from the magic-cooled chest close at hand. Carl snorted. I wouldn't be too happy with me either. What's he doing wandering through the park in that weather? Probably just wanted to get a glimpse of something green and growing, Terran said. He jerked his head in the direction of the barrier. It's not easy out there in the winter, you know, even in the city. That's when the commoners envy the mage-born the most. It's a good thing you make a point of going out there once in a while, cutting ribbons, making speeches. Otherwise that envy might turn into hate. Carl shook his head. They're fools if they envy me, he said. Oh, it's a nice enough prison. He looked around at the manicured grass, the flowering bushes, the sparkling blue lake with the sprawling white limestone palace on its far shore, the many-arched long bridge across the top of the dam that formed the lake. But it's still a prison. I suspect those held in Falk's dungeon would dispute your definitions, Terran said dryly. Carl laughed. True enough. He grinned affectionately at his bodyguard. So you're saying I should quit belly aching and enjoy myself? Exactly. Terran took another swig of ale. Like me. You're supposed to be protecting me, Carl pointed out. From what exactly, Terran said. Out there, he gestured at the snowstorm, sure, there could be a risk. I could see a commoner attacking you, since he might not understand how the magic works. But in here? He looked around. Unless some goose gets homicidal urges, you're safe as houses. No mageborn would ever attack the air. What would be the point? Carl laughed again. Lucky for you. He took a swallow of his own beer. Terran was quite right, of course. No mage lord or mage born would attack him because it would accomplish nothing. He might be the heir, but if he died, the keys, the special magic of the king that kept the great and lesser barriers in place, would simply choose a new heir. No one would know who that heir was until King Craven died and the keys made the leap to their new host. Since the new heir would be unknown, no one could influence that person ahead of time. Worse, the new heir might prove to be an enemy of whoever had arranged the assassination, someone who would then be able to act on that enmity with all the resources of the kingship once the keys came to him or her. Outside the barrier, he supposed it was conceivable, as Terran said, that some deranged commoner might attack him. He could even imagine, barely, some disgruntled mageborn attacking him. But all the mageborn who lived inside the barrier, southwest of the palace in the grand houses of the mageborn enclave, had sworn fealty to one of the five mage lords who served on the king's council. Well, almost all, he corrected himself. There were three types of mages residing within the barrier whose fealty was only to the king. A prime example of one type, the royal guard, currently sat next to him, drinking his beer. The healers were another. Though, like all mageborn, they had some modicum of hard magic, they had an additional skill, rare and valuable. They could use soft magic, useful for healing bodies and minds. Hannick, the first healer, resided in the palace like a mage lord, looking after the health, with the help of a handful of lesser-ranked healers, of everyone inside the lesser barrier. It was unthinkable one of them would be involved in any kind of violent attack on the air. Finally, there were the mages of the mage corps, who served the king under the direction of the first mage, Tagaza. Made up of the best and the brightest of those who passed through the College of Mages in Barryton, some 100 miles to the north, the Mage Corps did everything from making sure the palace's many magical systems continued operating, water running, toilets flushing, and lights turned on, as they put it, to researching the theory and practice of magic. Carl had met First Healer Hannick a few times when he'd suffered a broken bone or nasty cut from some childish misadventure. He met Tagaza almost daily, since Tagaza was his tutor in all things to do with magic and history. And above all, politics. Carl glanced at the palace again. It looked pure and white from this distance, almost half a mile away, but he knew better. It seethed with intrigue, everyone jockeying for power and position. There were 12 hereditary mage lords. Their ancestors had been the most powerful mages of their or any other day. Carl still found it hard to fathom what they had done, transporting themselves and a few hundred followers halfway around the world from the collapsing old kingdom. They had established the new kingdom of Evrenfels in the middle of a wilderness and erected the great and lesser barriers to protect the kingdom and themselves. Despite their extraordinary forebears, the current mage lords were not necessarily any more powerful magically than many ordinary mageborn, but that didn't matter. With the mage lords' titles came vast lands over which they could rule pretty much as they saw fit. 5 of the 12 held even greater power. They served on the king's council which governed the entire land. In the name of the king, of course, Carl thought sardonically, though he doubted King Craven knew about even a tenth of what was done in his name. The king's power lay in being able to appoint the members of the council, and since even on the council some positions were far more powerful and far more lucrative than others, every one of the 12 was constantly jockeying for the favor of the king and looking to undercut his or her rivals. Or would be, Carl thought, if my father would allow anyone to meet with them except for Lord Athol and Lord Falk. And of those two, prime adviser and minister of public safety, respectively, it was common knowledge that only Falk truly had the king's ear, which made Falk, who also commanded the royal guard and the army of Evrenfels, the most powerful man in the kingdom. Carl took another sip of beer as Taran lay back on the grass, hands behind his head, and closed his eyes. "You'd think the king might want to see his only son and heir once in a while, too," he thought, with a touch of familiar bitterness. "But you'd think wrong." He hadn't seen his father since the confirmation ceremony on his 18th birthday, half a year gone, when Tagaza had announced that he had tested Carl and that he was indeed the heir. It had been a very public ceremony, however, with all of the 12, their families, and even the commoner mayor and council of New Cabora in attendance, and he had not once had an opportunity to speak to the king. The last conversation with his father that he could recall now lay some 3 years in the past, and had focused entirely on the sad state of the ornamental gardens. The confirmation ceremony had meant that efforts by the mage lords to curry favor with the heir, already intensified by the inaccessibility of the king, had intensified even further. Previous royal lines had failed, the keys shifting to an heir outside the apparent succession, which was why the confirmation ceremony was a big deal. Now that there was no doubt Carl would one day be king, those mage lords not in the council, as well as those on the council hoping to keep or improve their current positions, sought to influence him so that the balance of power would shift their way on that sad day when death at last claimed King Craven. And as the mage lords sought his favor, so too did the mageborn sworn to their service, seeking to boost their own fortunes alongside their lords. Fortunately, Tagaza, who had been first mage for 2 decades and tutored Carl for the past 12 years, knew all about palace intrigue. Thanks to his guidance, Carl assumed an ulterior motive behind every gesture of support, every kind word, every gift, every invitation to a party or play, and kept his own counsel as to what he thought of the various mage lords. It sometimes seemed to Carl that, of all the people who dwelled inside the barrier, only Tagaza and Hannick, and the commoner servants, of course, but they hardly counted, had not tried, in ways large or small, to win his favor or turn him against rivals. Then he snorted. Not quite true. Falk hadn't tried either. The Minister of Public Safety didn't need Carl's favor, and Carl wasn't fool enough to think he could oust him from that position when he became king, even if he wanted to. In theory, the king could appoint whichever of the 12 he chose. In practice, Carl knew how it would work. Every other member of the 12 would refuse the position because they all feared Falk, leaving Carl in the end with no choice but to keep him, and in the meantime, he would have weakened himself in the eyes of everyone else. Maybe my dear father has the right idea, sequestering himself in the royal quarters and never bothering with any actual governing. He glanced at Taran and amended his earlier thought once more. Taran hadn't tried to win his favor either, but he didn't need to. He already had it. Taran's mother, a theoretical magician, spent her days researching in the palace archives and writing long, learned papers of which Carl understood 1 word in 10. He had met her once or twice. She lived in the Mageborn Enclave. Taran's father, though he had died when Taran was very young, had likewise been in the Mage Corps, though his duties had been more practical. He had been killed in a cave-in while recharging the mage lights in the commoner-worked coal mine that provided fuel for the mage furnace that burned day and night beneath the palace to provide energy for the magic of all the mageborn within the Lesser Barrier. Like Carl, Taran had grown up in the palace, and since they were almost of an age, the two boys had naturally fallen in with each other, roaming freely inside the barrier, swimming in the lake, buying ice cream in the enclave, chasing the geese, sneaking into the kitchen, and one night when they were 12, sneaking into the maid's bathing room. That had been memorable not only for the enlightenment and entertainment it had provided, but for revealing to Carl his own peculiar magical ability, an ability he had told no one about because it was too useful as a secret. As heir to the keys, Carl wasn't supposed to have any magic of his own. Certainly he couldn't light fires with a flick of his hand or move small objects without touching them, the way even the lowliest mageborn could. But that night, as the boys, passing through the hallways of the servants' quarters after a snack in the kitchens, had passed the bathing rooms, Carl, laughing to Taryn about how he'd love to sneak in there, had said, "Too bad they locked the doors with magic." And he had reached out and tugged on the handle, and the door had opened. Nobody had seen them that evening, though they'd gotten a delightful eyeful themselves. Taryn had said something about how lucky they'd been that the door had been unlocked, and left it at that. Carl, though, knew very well that the door had not been unlocked, but had come unlocked at his touch. After that, he'd started touching other enchanted items just to see what would happen. He only seemed to be able to deactivate small objects, locks, lights, heating stones. Near the palace's main entrance stood a famous magical timepiece that showed not only the time, but also the positions of the stars and planets as tiny whirling models inside a crystal dome. One day Carl had casually leaned against it for a while, then walked away. He'd been vaguely disappointed to see it still working, but a day later he saw two mages working on it, muttering about it needing adjustment for the first time in half a century. Mage Corps mages always seemed to be somewhere near his quarters trying to fix something that had unexpectedly failed. Once, when he was about 16, he'd even dared to touch the lesser barrier, though he'd been warned against it. People who had tried that before had suffered severe frostbite. No matter how cold it is, a quick touch won't hurt anything, he'd thought, and so he'd reached out, ready to snatch his hand away again in an instant, and hadn't felt any cold at all. In fact, the barrier had felt almost springy to his touch, like soft rubber. He'd snatched his hand back, and never tried that again. His best guess was that his strange power had something to do with his being air, but he'd never asked Tagaza about it, nor mentioned it to anyone else, even Taryn. The ability to de-magic small items, unlock locked doors, and turn out mage lights seemed much more useful as a secret than something for Tagaza to research, and tell Falk about. The first mage and Minister of Public Safety were close friends. It was hardly the only secret he held close. He and Taryn were still friends, but their relationship was very different now that Taryn was in the guard and he was the confirmed heir. "I have many more secrets than I did as a child," Carl thought. Then a frown flicked across his face. "I wonder if Taryn does, too." He shrugged aside that notion and the whole mass of circling thoughts about palace life and kingdom politics that more and more filled his mind these days, put down his beer bottle, and got to his feet. Stretching, he looked around at the wide, tree-studded lawn that sloped up from the lake to the barrier. This was one of his favorite places, with almost half a mile of water separating him from the palace. Few mageborn visited it, and it was off-limits to commoners, which gave him the illusion of solitude. His bodyguard accepted, of course. On days when the weather inside and out of the lesser barrier was the same, he sometimes rested here and pretended that nothing separated him from the rest of the world, that the barrier didn't even exist. He couldn't pretend that today, with winter still clawing New Kabora, and the sunlight within the barrier cast not by the true sun but by the mage sun, an enormous, intensely bright mage light that traversed the interior of the dome-shaped barrier whenever clouds shrouded the outside world. But at least he could pretend to be a free man, not the near-prisoner his birth had made him. He nudged the reclining Taryn in the side with his bare foot. Taryn opened one eye. "You called, Your Highness?" "I'm going for a swim," he said. "There'd better still be beer left when I come out." Taryn grinned. "I'm sure most of it will still be here." He sat up, put on his helmet, then got to his feet, leaned over and picked up his sword belt and buckled it on. "But first, of course, I have to do my job." Drawing his sword, he walked down to the edge of the lake. He peered into the water, searched up and down the grassy shore with his hand shading his eyes, and made a show of poking his blade into all the nearby bushes. He came back and saluted. "Guardsman Taryn reporting, sir," he said. "After a hard-fought battle, I have secured the beachhead." Carl touched his fingers to his forehead. "I salute you, sir. When I am king, you will have your just reward." "Actually, I'll take it now," Taryn said, "if it's all the same to your highness." He bent down, took a full bottle of beer from the open chest, pulled out the cork with his teeth, then raised the bottle to Carl. "Enjoy your swim," he said cheerfully, then took a swig. Carl laughed and strolled down to the lake, dropping his clothes as he went. Naked, he stood at the water's edge for a moment, gazing across the lake at the palace, glad to be here in the faux sunshine instead of locked in that den of greed, graft, and politics. Then he stepped forward. His foot touched the lapping waves, and 30 feet offshore, the lake erupted. A cloud of steam exploded outward, driving a ring of spray across the water. Carl staggered as the blast slammed into him. He glimpsed someone, clad in black, face hidden, standing impossibly on the surface of the water. The figure raised its right hand, pointing something at him. Light brighter than the mage sun flashed. and a far greater blast than the first hammered him to the ground. Ears ringing, blood running from his nose, acrid fumes burning his throat and eyes, he found himself on his back in the sand, staring up at a sky wreathed in smoke. Coughing and blinking away tears, he heaved himself up on one elbow. For 20 feet in every direction, the grass around him had burned black. A bush that a moment before had been clothed in small white flowers now stood as naked, shattered, and charred as though struck by lightning. His discarded kilt smoldered where it lay. Water that seconds before had been calm, glittering blue now tossed brown, foam-flecked wavelets against the muddy bank. A dozen feet from the shore bobbed something black and twisted. Carl heard Terran's booted feet thudding across the turf toward him, but the sound seemed to come from far away. He found himself standing without really remembering getting up, and then he was wading into the troubled water. He looked down at what floated there. Once it might have been human, but now it was as charred and twisted as the blasted bush. He stared at grinning teeth and a noseless ruin of a face, blind white eyes bulging from sockets whose lids had been burned away. His gaze traveled lower. The body was female. When Terran reached him, he was kneeling in the shallow water, his back to the blackened corpse, retching sour beer into the filthy gray waves. Beyond the shimmer of the lesser barrier, where falling and blowing snow mingled to conceal all in swirling curtains of white, Vinthor lowered his spyglass. He could no longer see through it anyway. Tears had flooded his eyes and frozen on his eyelashes. Lying on a snowdrift, half covered with snow himself, he would have been invisible to anyone passing within a dozen feet, much less someone blinded by the magical sunshine beyond the lesser barrier.
Jenna!
The name stabbed his heart like a knife. Had the invisible barrier not separated him as completely from the palace grounds as a wall of steel, he would have rushed the naked prince and strangled him with his bare hands, bodyguard be damned. That decadent, mage-born fool should continue to live, while beautiful Jenna, so young, so full of life, floated in the water as a withered, blackened corpse. He had cursed himself for misjudging his distance and coming unexpectedly onto the very verge of the barrier 15 minutes earlier, practically on top of the prince himself. He'd thought then that it didn't matter, that even if the prince and his guard, lolling at ease on the other side of the magical wall, did note his face well enough to later identify him, it would mean nothing with Jenna ready to strike. But the prince and the bodyguard both lived, and Jenna, unthinkably, did not. He scraped the freezing tears from his eyes, then snapped the spyglass closed. Clambering to his feet, he struggled through the snow away from the barrier, back toward the shadowy, smoky streets of New Cabora. He wanted no one on the other side to see him now, for certain. He would report what had happened to the patron. He did not think the patron would be pleased.